Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Joseph Ellis's ability to bring our founders to life, to strip away the cobwebs, mythology, and hero worship, and to show them as real people whose failures and frustrations merit the same examination as their enormous successes has made his books national bestsellers and earned him a National Book Award for American Sphinx and a Pulitzer Prize for Founding Brothers. Now in his new book, Revolutionary Summer, The Birth of American Independence, he turns to the most dramatic months in the story of our country's founding. It is a great pleasure to welcome Joseph Ellis to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Joe, it's my pleasure to be back with you.
We always love having you on the program. Give us a sense of what led you to this period. Obviously, a period that has been written about many, many times, and finding something new and finding a story that you wanted to tell.
Well, that's it. It is a story that's been told by several generations of historians. It's a familiar story, familiar to a lot of Americans because of the popular play 1776. And when I go about selecting the topic, I do ask myself the question, what is the story you want to tell? Not what is the person you want to study or the topic you want to investigate, but the story you want to tell. And I gave myself 6 months to study the documents and evidence about this period in the summer of 76 to see if I could come up with some distinctive, fresh, and even original insights. And I started to do that, and so I decided to go forward with the story. And the key is to see that there is a political story that's centered on the Continental Congress in Philadelphia, and there's a military story going on at the same time centered on the Continental Army in New York, and that in order to tell the real story, you've got to put those two stories together. And that's what I'm trying to do here and show the way the two sides interact and create the kind of crescendo moment in American history.
How informed were they of one another, or how much were they acting by themselves and in a vacuum?
You mean the two sides, the Philadelphia and the New York side of the story?
Yes.
They were very much aware of what was going on. I mean, it took a day or two for word to get there back and forth, but decisions being made in Philadelphia were influenced by what happened in New York. Though when the American Army, the Continental Army, got defeated in August in a horrible defeat in Long Island, while the Continental Congress knew about it, and the army almost was annihilated in that one battle, most of Americans didn't, because the press didn't report it. And I read about 14 newspapers, and they reported America's defeat as a victory. To be truthful as a journalist was treasonable at that moment in American history. And so most of the American public didn't know how bad things were going in the war, though the members of Congress did.
You write in the book about how the support for independence came together rather quickly in the spring of 1776, more for military reasons than for political reasons.
Exactly right. That's another very good example, probably the best example of the interface between the military and political sides of the story. That is, up until the middle spring of 76, while New England was pretty committed, they were ready to rock and roll because they were occupied by the British Army and they felt they had no choice. The rest of the American colonies were divided, and the dominant position was the so-called moderate position, both within the Congress and within the countryside. Namely, there must be a diplomatic way out of this, and there was a diplomatic way, but the British weren't willing to allow it to happen. That is, let the colonies govern themselves in terms of taxation, but remain within the empire as economic units and under the king, sort of an early version of the British Commonwealth. But In the middle spring of 76, what happened is that the British decided to launch this huge invasion, 42,000 soldiers and sailors, largest amphibious force ever to cross the Atlantic, to crush the American rebellion in the cradle. And as news of that decision and then the sailing of the British fleet reached America, that began to change American popular opinion. Ironically, the British invasion was designed to crush the rebellion. It created consensus on independence instead. And the bulk of the people were really saying, and there's lots of documents to show this, we really have no choice. George III has declared his independence of us, and we are surprised at the suddenness of our conversion, but we really have no choice, but we now commit ourselves to the cause.
And there obviously has to be that, there has to be political support that comes quickly following that military necessity then.
Well, the political support is, in a sense, the vote in the Congress that happens not on the 4th. Everybody mistakes that. It really happens on July 2nd, when the resolution that these colonies are and have right to be independent states is voted on by the 13 colonies represented in Congress in Philadelphia. Adams always thought that would be the day that we would celebrate for American independence. He writes Abigail saying that this will be the day when parades and speeches and even illuminations. He gets everything right down to the fireworks, but he gets the day wrong. Truth is, not a lot happened on the 4th. What happened on the 4th was the full Congress sent the declaration to the printer, but they wrote July 4th at the top of the document because that was the day they were finished debating it and sent it to the printer. But they didn't sign it on that date either. I mean, again, that's where the play, for dramatic reasons, somewhat falsifies history. Most of them signed it on August 2nd, but there were people signing it into the fall, these reluctant revolutionaries and the stragglers.
Yes, there have been history books written making the case for 1775 being the year of our independence.
That's a new book, yeah. And that, I think if you were talking just about New England, that would really be true. New England's opinion is has congealed, again, because of the occupation of the British Army and because of the closing of the British port, martial law in Massachusetts. That opinion there congeals earlier and more comprehensively than in other colonies. But there are pockets of loyalism. About 20% of the populace is loyalist. And then there's this group, it's hard to know how big it was, maybe 30% of people who really just want the whole thing to go away. They want to remain neutral. And once independence is formally declared, it's difficult to remain neutral. You have to go one way or the other. And there's enormous political pressure put on people in different communities to come along with this or else risk being persecuted.
You address this question in many different ways in the book, and I think it's fascinating how you do so. And that is the question, was there any realistic chance for the British to win?
Well, it's a different way to put the question because most of the time the question is put, was there any way the Americans, this amateur group of Continental soldiers whose average experience in the Army was 6 months or less, could defeat the British Army, where the average experience was 7 years, and with the British Navy, together with the Army, is the finest military force in the world. So how can this ragtag group of amateurs beat the British Army and Navy? But the alternative way to see it, and I think the better way to see it, is did the British ever have a realistic chance to win? I mean, I think that our own experience as a nation in Southeast Asia and the Middle East makes us more aware than we would have been before of the dilemma facing the British Army. If it was just a contest of armies, they would have won easily, but it wasn't. It was a contest for hearts and minds. And that was going to be a difficult fight for them to win. And I guess the way I'd put it is their only real chance was to win it quickly and decisively at the very beginning. And that opportunity presented itself in New York in the summer of 76. They missed it. And when they missed that, it was going to be very difficult for them to win the war.
Joseph Ellis is the author of the book Revolutionary Summer, The Birth of American Independence. It is published by Knopf. Let us talk a little bit more about that, and specifically about the British misunderstanding the colonial rebellion. Give us some insight into that misunderstanding.
The British ministry understood that they were facing in New England, especially in Massachusetts, a dedicated group of patriots. And the experience of Bunker Hill really taught them a lesson. That was a bloodbath for the British Army. They lost 1,000 troops in a few hours there. One British retired general was heard to say, a few more victories like this and the British Army will be annihilated. But they basically decided, and George III is the real decider, to use a George W. Bush term here, that they were going to therefore quash this thing. And they believed that outside of New England, the support for the rebellion was skin deep, that you could isolate New England and that the support for the American rebellion would evaporate if they were if it was demonstrated militarily that they couldn't win. That was their misreading of the popular opinion. Though it's also wrong to say that everybody who wasn't a loyalist was a patriot. There's this middle group of people who are very difficult to track or identify. But the British, under the Howe brothers, in their invasion of Long Island and Manhattan, really didn't want to destroy the Continental Army. They wanted to show it, to teach it a lesson, to give it a stunning blow. And then, once they had demonstrated their military superiority, to negotiate, because they believed that most Americans wanted to end this war diplomatically, but that would have meant stepping back from independence and accepting some role in the British Empire that, as I said earlier, is somewhat akin to what we would come to be called Commonwealth status. That wasn't the way. It's difficult to know what most Americans thought, but the leadership in the Continental Congress, especially people like Adams and Franklin, were resolute. Once we stepped across the line for independence, we were never turning back.
And you make the point, even with this decision by the Howes to deliberately choose not to end the war, perhaps, and destroyed the Continental Army on Long Island and Manhattan. But even if that had happened, the British still would have been in trouble.
Well, that's, you know, one of those unanswerable questions. And because it didn't happen, it's fun to talk about, because Franklin and Adams both confronted Richard Howe in the Stone House on Staten Island in September 11th. And he said, look, we've just defeated you decisively on Long Island. You can't win. You need to recognize that and reach some sort of reconciliation here. And both of them said the same thing, that, look, it doesn't make any difference to us what happens if you destroy the Continental Army. We'll just raise another army. We have over 300,000 American males between the ages of 15 and 50, and we will find them. And if you capture Washington, we'll find another Washington. They were in all in, and they were not turning back. In fact, Franklin told Howe that it was just the opposite, that he had no way of winning the war, and he should recognize that fact and take his ships and go back to London, or else his whole reputation would be destroyed. It's impossible to know the right answer to this. I mean, I think they could have replaced the troops. It's difficult to know how they could have replaced Washington. He was as close to indispensable as possible. And so historians could disagree about this. It's possible that, you know, that there's a chance that the war would have been ended if, in fact, the Continental Army was destroyed. And arguing that there was no possibility is a kind of act of faith.
It is fascinating in the reading of this book of looking at the negotiations with Franklin, who you mentioned, and where his strength came from and why he was so sure of American success.
Well, it is because Franklin was late to the revolutionary cause. He had been living in England for 19 years and just returned to America in late 75. And he was one of those people who believed that this conflict could never become an open outbreak or a revolution, that it was too obvious that the British benefited from the American colonies and that they would not kill the goose that laid the golden egg. And there would be a diplomatic resolution of this thing. Sensible women would get together and figure it out. That didn't happen. And in fact, he was then vilified before the House of Lords in a famous scene when he was, you know, made the epitome of colonial intransigence. And that converted him. And his son, or his illegitimate son, really, was the loyalist governor of New Jersey. And when he Franklin went over, he disowned his son. And he became one of the most ardent of all patriots, and kept telling the British that this was the biggest blunder in the history of British statecraft.
In researching the book, once you had the idea, once you had the concept of looking at these two narratives, both the political and the military, then what was your plan for going forward in finding out the information to make that argument?
Well, I had there one body of information that helped me a lot, that's buried in research libraries, most people don't know about them, is something called American Archive. It's 9 volumes put together in the 1840s by an archivist named Charles Force, who wanted to gather together all the documents from the Revolutionary era before they went out of existence. These include letters, pamphlets, newspaper articles, congressional debates or parliamentary debates. They're not indexed and they're hard to use. But what they give us, for example, in my case, is in May of 76, the Continental Congress sent out a request from every colony to rewrite its constitution. And the different colonies then sent out that request to all their towns and counties. And in the American Archive, you've got the response of all those towns and counties. And you can know what people are really thinking. And that's where you get the clear sense that the invasion is what changes their mind. Beyond that, I'm a believer in agency, meaning that people make a difference in history. One of my goals was to tell the story in a way that brought to life again some of these most famous characters, this time in moments that are really dire, especially Washington. This is the worst moment in Washington's life. He is in almost clinical depression throughout this period because he thinks that he's on the verge of losing the war. And there's not a heck of a lot he can do about it because his army is so inferior. So trying to track his story and his psyche, if you will, through this period is a real opportunity and challenge at the same time. But I would say the same thing about Adams in this moment. This is Adams' greatest moment in American history. His presidency is nothing compared to this. This is his finest hour. And as a writer, trying to recover those characters, if you will, was one of my goals.
Going back to Washington for a second, I found your portrait of him fascinating because certainly we see his brilliance as a commander and in his leadership. But also, as you point out, there's a lot of just good old-fashioned luck involved as well.
Yeah, especially they get trapped by the British Army on Long Island, on Brooklyn Heights, and there's really no way out because the British control the Long Island Sound and the East River. And yet he manages the most difficult of all military maneuvers, a strategic retreat at night. It's really hard. And he's lucky as the dickens because a nor'easter comes in to create currents that make it difficult for British frigates to cruise in the East River. A fog comes in to cover the retreat. It's in some ways, it is the most brilliant tactical move of the entire war on the American side. It's not written about or painted about, if you will, because it's a defeat. But it's a really crucial strategic move because without it, the Continental Army would have been annihilated. And that's might have been the end of the war. So he's lucky. Providence is what he would call it. Didn't talk so much about God as providence. And the experience of these defeats on Long Island and in Manhattan begin to change Washington's strategic thinking about the war. Washington begins with a really honor-driven sense of battle. When an enemy presents itself on the field, you are required to meet him in the same way that you're required to answer a summons to a duel. That is a big mistake. He should have really never tried to defend New York in the first place. It was an archipelago that was indefensible if you didn't control the seas. And he begins to, his thought process begins to change in the late summer. He comes to understand that what he's got to fight is a different kind of war, a more defensive war, what he calls a war of posts, in which it's not his job to win the war, it's his job not to lose it.
At the end of the book, you have a postscript that is entitled Necessary Fictions. What are some of the necessary fictions?
Well, on the American side, one of the necessary fictions that begins to develop early in the 19th century as the war becomes history is that the war was won by the militia. This is the myth of the militia. And the Minutemen at Concord and Lexington and Bunker Hill were crucial in that regard. But throughout most of the war, certainly in most of the conventional battles, the militia were a disaster. The militia ran away. In the Battle of New York, they just desert in droves. Militia are not effective troops in conventional battles. And yet the American public wanted to believe that myth because the real truth is more difficult to accept, that the war was won by a standing army. The war was won by the Continental Army of regulars. And the animus against a standing army was really strong back then. And therefore, they wanted it to look like and sound like a victory that was in keeping with American ideological beliefs. On the British side, they wanted to figure out a way to explain the defeat in the war, and the way they came up with it's somewhat similar to what the American press does in the Vietnam War. They find a scapegoat, and this is William Howe. William Howe becomes the Westmoreland of the American Revolution, and they believe that if Howe had been more adventurous or more aggressive in New York, they could have won the war at the very beginning of the war, and it all would have turned out differently. That they don't have to face the fact that the British Empire itself decided to fight this war, and for imperial reasons. They could have had a diplomatic resolution, but they wanted to impose their will imperially on these colonies, and it was that decision that led to their real defeat.
The name of the new book is Revolutionary Summer, The Birth of American Independence. It is an amazing volume. It is published by Knopf. Joseph Ellis, a great pleasure. I thank you so much for taking the time out to share with us.
It's my pleasure once again.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book is Revolutionary Summer, The Birth of American Independence. It is published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.